WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
After covering China since the 1960s, journalist Orville Schell is quite surprised by some of what he's seen and heard over the last week in China as he's followed President Clinton on his tour. Schell didn't expect that the president would have the opportunity twice to address the Chinese people directly in live TV broadcasts, first in a debate with the president of China, Jiang Zemin, then in a question and answer session with students at Beijing University. We spoke with Schell last week from Xi'an, just before Clinton's arrival. We called Schell again early this morning in Beijing. Schell is the author of several books about China and is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. I asked him which comments by President Clinton have had the greatest impact in China.
Well, I think just to hear a leader from afar standing beside the leader of China and raising the question of the Beijing massacre and the demonstrations in 1989, raising the question of human rights, raising the question of Tibet in a very collegial way, and then to see the leader of China not freeze in defensiveness, but actually parry the blow in a way, I think that was very surprising for Chinese. It was certainly surprising for Westerners. But I think what it represented was, and why it was so significant, even though nothing quite was agreed to, was that it represented one of the very first times that a Chinese leader has not been defensive. And so much of China's posture, I think really since the Opium War, has been very defensive. It has been, they easily get in this victim syndrome where the West is beating up on them and Japan is occupying them. But here was President Jiang going blow for blow with Clinton in a friendly way on the most sensitive and delicate issues, which everybody had skirted around in public diplomatic exchanges previously.
Do you think that this says something about the direction China is heading in, or just something about President Jiang?
Well, that's a very interesting question. As I sat in that room, and then 2 days later out at Beijing University, where Clinton again made an address that was publicly broadcast all across the country, it did occur to me that something was changing of a rather tectonic nature in China, as it periodically does, or President Jiang was opening himself to some risk of seeming to run possibly under the skirts of the West, which is a place that a Chinese leader does not want to be because of the great sensitivity to seeming to either submit to the West or to be too enamored of the West. And yet this is what happened, and I wondered and still do wonder the dangers of him going too far, because behind him is sort of the part of the iceberg, or underneath him, that's underwater we can't see. And, you know, we forget at our peril that this place had a communist revolution that lasted for four decades, and many people consecrated themselves to it wholeheartedly, and many people were shaped by it and still contain sort of the recessive genes of that revolution in there, the way they look at the world and don't shine kindly on people who run off and dance with American presidents in too profligate a way.
Do you have any clue what happened behind the scenes when the Clinton administration people were trying to convince Chinese officials to broadcast the debate with President Jiang and the Clinton address before Beijing University?
Well, this was a very important point to President Clinton because, I mean, he has to defend himself against critics in the American Congress. And what good does it do if he comes and says a few things and no one ever hears about it? So they didn't know, and we didn't know, when we went into the Great Hall of the People to sit down in this room, whether, in fact, this was being broadcast. In fact, most of us thought it was very, very unlikely that it would be. It was only when the thing ended that we learned that it had gone out all across the country. I mean, and they estimate, you know, around 600 million viewers. Not a bad viewing audience. So this was quite a concession that the Chinese made. But interestingly enough, just to so that we don't lose touch with the fact that they still feel very sensitive about these sorts of expressions, the newspapers the next day did not print any of the loaded, sensitive discussion. They had an expurgated version that went out over the New China News Agency. So, I mean, it's what we also see is that the media can be divided into different sections. And just because the president says broadcast this, it doesn't mean that, that everybody else will jump too and do the same sort of dissemination. And this is a classic pattern that different parts of the media fight with each other because maybe they're more conservative and they really didn't want to be the vectors of this new kind of openness.
I remember the first time we spoke during this trip to China, you said that a friend of yours had suggested that Hillary Clinton wear white at Tiananmen Square because white is actually the color of mourning in China. Mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, and that that would be a kind of silent but symbolic protest of the government crackdown at Tiananmen Square in 1989. So what did she wear?
Well, she did not wear white. I think she wore a pantsuit if recollection serves. And, I mean, indeed, this trip has been not exactly replete with efforts to meet the opposition, to meet dissidents. I mean, for instance, the former premier and party chief who was cashiered in 1989 went to the square and with tears in his eyes said to the students late one night, you know, we've come too late, and then vanished. Well, he's been under house arrest for 9 years, is probably the most famous political prisoner in China, never charged, never tried, just put in his house. There's been no talk about him, no effort to see him. I guess the feeling has been, as ever, that you can only push it so far without getting back into that sensitive territory where the Chinese will start bucking and bridling, and you won't have enough engagement and sort of a fund of friendship to be able to get any momentum forward on these issues. And this, of course, is a subject of enormous contention back home as to whether Clinton should have missed this opportunity to symbolically cast some attention on people who had kids killed in 89 or dissidents or people who've been in prison, are in prison.
So tell us a little bit about your adventures traveling around with the press through China during Clinton's trip.
Well, it's like being on some cruise ship in a way, including what one photographer friend of mine calls the death by buffet. Because wherever we land, there is a hotel that's taken over. There's this huge room where all of the members of the press have a phone and have a little place to sit to file. It's a filing center. And then outside, there are tables groaning with chafing dishes and pastries and everything under the sun 24 hours a day. And you are sort of, it's like being in a harem. You're kept in here, and people don't very often get out except for when the buses will take you to a president's speech, to the square, for some official event, and there's very little time to get out, and most of the press can't speak Chinese, and they don't know really where they are, and so they're kind of victims of this very closed environment and sort of get moved around with great efficiency by the White House travel office and the people who are handling the press and taking us to all these events. So there's a kind of an air of unreality about it all, and you can go to city after city and never quite get your feet wet in anything but this sort of prearranged and very well-organized juggernaut of a press tour.
Where have you gone off the beaten track?
Well, I often will try to slip out and, you know, go to a little restaurant and talk with people or at Beijing University to speak with students after he addressed them. And, you know, he was quoting Ben Franklin about the need for criticism, that critics are our best allies because they help us see where we are wrong and change. I went out and wandered around the campus a bit and talked to students. And it was very interesting. He then gave a whole bunch of books to the Beijing University Library, and exactly on the place where this little ceremony was conducted, out in front of the new wing of the library donated by this Hong Kong billionaire, there used to be this gargantuan concrete statue of Chairman Mao that a number of years ago they put a stick of dynamite in and blew up and hauled off one night. Everywhere you go, unless you've been around, you don't quite see the history, and you don't know how the place has changed, how the imagery has changed, how the ideology has changed. And of course, this is the really perplexing thing for me about China, is how can a country and a society change its identity so that, you know, at one point, not so long ago, you have Chairman Mao exhorting everybody to punch the air with their red Bibles and promote class struggle. And then suddenly we have Bill Clinton out there quoting Ben Franklin and talking about, pluralism and democracy. If it's bewildering to us, imagine what it's like to Chinese who are trying to figure out, in effect, what does it mean to be Chinese? What's the core value of this whole enterprise?
My guest is journalist Orville Schell, who's in Beijing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the conversation we recorded early today with journalist Orville Schell in Beijing. When we spoke last week, shortly after you arrived in China, you were telling us a little bit about some of the changes that you were seeing in China since your last trip there. Tell us more about changes that you've seen that are surprising.
Well, you know, I have this feeling about China that at last it's becoming a normal country. It was a little before, I don't know what the analogy was, the only one I can think of, and it's a kind of a comical one, was that the China was something like the Coneheads on Saturday Night Live. I mean, they were pretending that nobody noticed, you know, that they were somehow from another world, and they were claiming to be from France. China just didn't seem normal. It didn't relate to other people in a kind of a friendly, open, spontaneous way. Its leaders were somehow isolated. They spoke in a strange jargon. It was very hard to get through to them. People were standoffish. You never knew quite how to read the situation. And the truth was, people were afraid. And now there's this great sigh of relaxation, and it's as if you see the human side of people. They don't seem so sort of extraterrestrial in some other inexplicable world that you can't quite understand. Cafes are opening everywhere in Beijing and Shanghai now, little dives, and there's music. In fact, the hotel I'm in now, I was just coming up through the lobby, and I heard someone playing stride piano in the lounge, and walked over, and it was a young Chinese man playing very well. They're the first gay clubs have opened up. We're beginning to get a kind of a growth of the margins world where people can be who they are, where they're not harassed. A whole expansion of areas of freedom, which do not, alas, extend into public expressions of political sentiment. And this is the rub. The party has circled the wagons around a smaller circumference of taboo territory, but it happens to involve the rights of people to say something about how they are governed and to participate in their governance.
What do you think the after effects of this trip might be on relations between China and the United States?
Well, I think they're going to be much warmer, and I do think that because of the personal relationship, and because in fact Clinton has given Jiang Zemin faith, something will come back. There is always payments. The question is, what will the payment be, and how far can Jiang Zemin go to repay his new friend Bill Clinton without antagonizing this very strange, you know, stage crew, cast of characters that exists behind the stage sets on which this week was played. And this is a very, very complicated set of political factions. It has many very conservative strains in it, and as I suggested earlier, does not always take kindly to profligate expressions of friendship with foreign powers.
But they made each other look good. President Clinton made President Zheng look good by being there, right, and by having this open communication. And President Zheng made Clinton look good by giving him access to live television and not censoring what he said.
Well, I think Zheng got more out of it than Clinton did. But I think that was always in the game, that Clinton was going to give this to him. He was going to give him this face, give him this relationship in this 9 days, and see if that could sort of beef up the, quote, relationship to the point where we might actually be able to get some progress. But, you know, we love to think of China as an authoritarian dictatorship with a big ruler at the top who just can pull levers and make things happen, but it doesn't happen that way. For instance, in Shanghai today, there's a big rhubarb going on because there's a Chinese Kunqu opera troupe that's been training to go to Lincoln Center. And they're supposed to open on July 7th to do the Peony Pavilion. And there's some very conservative person in the cultural bureau there in Shanghai won't let them go because thinks the opera's too salacious. Who knows what's going on? There's a big beef going on. There's a big mess. And it's a reminder that beneath the surface, there are forces at work that even the Communist Party chief really has no control over.
One of the things this shows is that even if the president is trying to open up a little bit, there are so many people on a kind of lower scale in the power pyramid who will still be really happy to exert their power in petty ways and to censor things in any way that they can on their level.
It's absolutely true. And one of the things that's happening in China is a kind of a feudalization of the country, so that cities or provinces or even counties have an enormous amount of power now, which derives basically from their economic power. And people in Beijing really don't have the ability to tell them what to do. And moreover, they're very loath to try, because if they fail, it would be a public demonstration of their weakness. So I think their attitude most often, and this goes for the arrest of dissidents too, better say nothing so people don't see that you can't actually affect national policy on a local level.
Orville Schell spoke to us from Beijing. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. Schell's books about China include Discos and Democracy and Mandate of Heaven. He's currently writing a book about Tibet and Western images of it.